among the functions I think I have here this period of weeks is to see if there are things that arise out of the program of our time at Holden, which perhaps call for some discussion or something of that sort. And so I am among the staff people, I think maybe about the only one who is officially allowed to be unprepared.
Expected to be unprepared.
Yeah. So I did think that there have been some things happening, especially in the experience of those of us who may have been here for several days, backing up into the Rainbow experience for a number of days, and coming down through this evening. I don't recall exactly the title of the discussion that was put on the blackboard, but something like Cultures at Worship. And by that, what I meant was that I think we could spend some fruitful time reflecting on the worship life that we have had here at Holden in the past few days. We could generalize upon that. We could reflect on how that may or may not have some carryover value into our own congregations, whether or not we have particular official responsibility for worship in our congregations. I think that's probably irrelevant. So that's the general idea, anyway, and I would like to introduce you to some of the thoughts that have been rocking around inside of my head. And then at some point I'll turn it over to you. I will try to manipulate you, however, to deal with the questions that I would like to ask. You, however, may do a return favor and choose to deal with a whole other set of questions that would be a part of your agenda. And it seems to me that that would also be fair. The subtitle, then, of our discussion this evening would be something like The Interaction of Culture and the Worship Practice in Our Churchly Life. It's not a question of if culture will interact with our worship practice. It simply does that in an inevitable way. There is no way that we as human beings who live in this finite world, using the tools and instruments and kinds of vehicles of communication that we have, can simply say that we choose not to have any cultural influence on our worship practice. So it's a matter of, shall it be an unconscious encroachment of the culture into that which we do at our principal services on Sunday, is primarily what I'm thinking of, or shall it be an intentional tool, that is, shall culture be used as an intentional tool of communication as we attempt to handle God's word and holy things? I'd like to clarify what I am meaning for this evening, at least, by the term culture, and for that I will be indebted to Frank Sen. One of the things that triggered my thinking in this direction was remembering that last year I spent my vacation with this particular book, or a part of it. Frank Sen, a former prof at Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, wrote Christian Worship and Its Cultural Setting. I really thought I'd get a whole lot of help and could plagiarize great portions of this for my introduction this evening. It doesn't quite fit that well, but nevertheless, I commend the book to you. I think it's in the bookstore. This one, at least, is the library copy here at Holden. And Professor Sen says that in the way we use culture here, we're referring to those elements of style and devotional expression that are added to the basic structure and fundamental shapes of our worship practice. For instance, just prayer would be a part of our regular fundamental structure of a worship service. How that prayer is put together, whether it is prepared in advance or not, of the kind of vocabulary and imagery that is used in that prayer. Those are the places where culture has not only an opportunity to enter in, but in fact does enter in, either intentionally or unintentionally. Hymns, of course, are another obvious one. I don't know how it is in your congregation, the one where I worship, people will say, you know, we want to sing the familiar hymns. To which I arrogantly reply, familiar to whom? We happen to have a very diverse congregation, and so I can get away with that. But at any rate, in the selection and even in the how of hymns, the sources of hymns, all of those things have cultural overtones. The why of dealing with this particular topic in this week is that I think that in our experience here at Holden in the last few days, it has brought into focus a kind of confusion on this issue that is always there. But it just happens that because of the rainbow experience and the styles of worship practice that we've had, especially at Vespers, it has brought into focus some of that. On the one hand, there have been comments made, not directly in the Vesper service, but in other settings, that tend to disparage the dominant Western culture, and which seem to say we ought to try to worship in our formal ways without any influence from the culture. We ought to strive in our preparation in the parish for an acultural worship. Well, I've already indicated, I think, that's an impossible thing to do. But nevertheless, there has been that hint that the Western culture has become so demonic in many respects that it ought not to be a part of our worship life. And so with that happening over here and then over here in our Rainbow Week, we've had these marvelous evening experiences of worshiping pretty much in the black style. In very definite, precise culture, with the influence of very definite and precise culture, or at least a portion of the black American Christian culture in our worship. And so I suspect, or at least I have felt, there's a certain amount of confusion, which would say something like, if we tracked it out, if it is a great and wonderful thing to worship in the black style, is there another great and wonderful way to worship, if and when appropriate, in a white style? And of course in North American or Native American and those other kinds of ways. This is not a new problem. Another book that many of you probably know, which speaks to this issue in a broader way, H. Richard Niebuhr's Christ and Culture, has been around. I suppose that was written in the 50s. Anybody know the date? And Niebuhr indicates that in terms of theology, as well as in worship practice and every other way in the Christian life, let's see what he calls it. Calls it, first of all, an enduring problem, which seems to mean that probably we're not going to solve it in the next 44 minutes. Also, there was a better term that I jotted down here somewhere that he... the double wrestle of the church. The double wrestle of the church with its Lord and with the cultural society in which the church lives. I think those of us who live close to the church feel that double wrestle a whole lot. Has something to do with our integrity as Christians, and if we happen to be on the church payroll, it has something to do with how we manage to get through our day with any kind of integrity. And if we have some responsibility for planning and preparing worship events, it has a lot to say with the integrity there. How do we wrestle with the demands of our Lord, and at the same time deal with the troublesome nature of the several cultures with which we're involved? The other reason I think this could well be addressed this week is that we have been sensitized, those of us who have been here for several days, to not just the black culture, but to the possibilities of what can happen in our worship practice and in other aspects of our Christian life. Many of us came here as Lutherans believing ourselves to be evangelical Catholics, and we thought that we knew what that meant a week or two ago. Evangelical meaning that we came to Holden Village, many of us, believing that we are involved with the good news, and that to be an evangelical Catholic, that is to be a good Lutheran, means that we want to be sure that that news is good, that it is good for us, and that it comes from the proper or appropriate source, namely from the Word of God. We also thought when we came to Holden that as good Lutherans or evangelical Catholics, that we felt that we were in the great train of the Christian faith from the day of our Lord, or perhaps even Abraham and Sarah, on down through that long train of witnesses down to the present day, participants and fellow citizens in the kingdom of God through all those years. And yet in recent days at Holden, I think we have felt there's something inside of us that says, well, all of that's okay, but we probably need to broaden that out, or perhaps even redefine what we mean by being evangelical and by being Catholic, small c. Let's see, you read. Yeah, your left is over there. Okay, it's Catholic, yeah. This way. Universal. We need to redefine. Evangelical, and we need to look at evangelical again in that we no longer want to ask the question, is the news simply good for me? But is the news good for everyone? Beyond that, if the news is good for me, and if the news is to be good for everyone, ought not there to be something in our worship practice which says that we ought to be among those, perhaps the principal ones, who are out there making that news become good, or at least communicating that good news to all those who are within our reach? And so it's a broadening of the evangelical principle. Also a broadening of the principle of Catholicity, literally a broadening as I see it. We have thought of ourselves as Catholic primarily in the terms of the length of the church down through history. I think our time here in recent days has certainly convinced us that there is a breadth to the church that we were intellectually aware of beforehand, of course, but this, in these days, we've been involved in some of that breadth. It's been a strong, very significant kind of involvement for many of us. We probably don't want to go home and just leave that behind on the mountain. How can we, as Lutheran Christians, if that is our particular label, or of any other that might be represented in our group tonight, how can we be Catholic and experience on a regular basis that breadth of the church back in the place where we normally function? I'll be done here in a minute, and then I'll let you talk. Just a couple of other terms I wanted to toss out, and then I'll let you have pretty much the ball. Another thing I think that we have been very much concerned with this week in our worship life together, and with the people of the Rainbow, most of whom I think already went home, but we continue to have that influence. Words like relevancy, which we thought went out with, I guess, the 60s or the 70s, and inclusivity. As we think of the practical nature of our congregations, as most of them seem to exist, at least in our end of the church, how can we see that our worship practice is not only evangelical and Catholic, but also relevant and inclusive? How can we see that, well, let me put it this way. Back in the days when we had a concern only for one culture, i.e. our own, which probably meant the dominant culture, and given the nature of our group tonight, I'll say the white culture, that we could get away without being our major concern. We knew what was relevant to people like us. We all had pretty much the same kinds of worries and concerns. Inclusivity for us generally meant, do we cover several layers of the economic spectrum? Do we have a few professionals in our congregation and a few blue-collar workers, and that was about it. But I think now, through our rainbow experience, we do have a concern for experiencing, if possible, the much wider area of inclusivity and relevancy, recognizing how difficult that might be and how complex it will become beyond what we had experienced before. So that's by way of introduction. I have a first question for you, which I've already put on the board. And this is where you have the poll. You can say, I don't like that question. And we want to try, we don't have questions 1, 2, and 3. We have a black one and a green one and a blue one. But if, in the general way, we're going to talk about how culture enters into our worship. Let's just talk about Sunday morning. I guess we all are a tradition that worships primarily on Sunday morning in the principal service of the week. Seems to me one of the questions we have got to ask somewhere near the beginning is, who is the audience of our worship? At least a couple of possibilities, so you can figure out what those are. And how does the audience of our worship, that is the primary person or persons that is being addressed, how does that affect the cultural accoutrements, the cultural things, how we put together, how we structure, how we what vocabulary we choose to use in our worship? This has to do with another question that may become appropriate if you want to deal with that one. Who is the audience of our worship?
I guess I have trouble with, excuse me, mm-hmm. It should be downstairs. But I have trouble with the word audience.
I hope so.
Because, I mean, this is not a performance.
Okay, who is the primary person or persons that is being addressed?
God.
Okay, there's one person who says God. I don't know if that's right or wrong. It doesn't need to be right or wrong. I guess that's what we learned in Sunday church school, isn't it? That we go to worship in order to address God. We use terms like praise and thanksgiving and all that, so that God becomes, in one sense, the audience, the one being addressed, or the auditor of our worship. Are there other ones?
About the church council.
The church council. I didn't follow that one. All right.
It's really interesting. You know, Sarah said God, and a number of people went, yeah, and we were all thinking that. I didn't think of that at all. I was thinking...
Cool, Jack.
I was thinking of two congregations that we go to, and in one congregation, the audience is a group of white, primarily old. Primarily middle class, and it's just rather striking to me that I oftentimes feel empty at church, and I think maybe one of the reasons for that is because I perceive what's happening there to be that we are the audience in a not real healthy way, rather than God being the center of our life and trying to wrestle with what that means.
Would you be willing to surrender your church council to this wider idea of the congregation,
or say that
if you're looking out there, whether you sit in the front, the back, or which age bracket group sits in the center right or center left, and which ones sit with family, and which ones are the gray haired people that sit over here, and who sits in the last three pews, I think that's a holistic idea.
Uh-huh.
And each one's looking for something in their part of the audience.
Okay. How many of you use and like the term worship experience? Let's be honest. In the past several days, we have had worship services in the evening, and when we have come out, we have commented to those people who have been with us at that point as to whether we liked it or we didn't like it, or whether it was warm or whether it was strange or whether it was good, because we have had a subjective experience, right?
New experiences
in many cases. Am I that far off? I don't see many heads wagging. Well, at any rate, I think as we deal with our regular Sunday communities back home, we do have these two audiences. Let's call this, instead of the church council, kind of ourselves. Those of us who are worshiping are also the audience of our worship. Now, this fits in real well with some of our traditional theology, we'll call it congregation. We learned in some kind of confirmation program or other about some things being sacrificial and other things being sacramental, and we don't really remember what those words mean, and that's okay, except that in some aspects of our worship and Christian life, God is addressing us, and in other aspects of what we do as Christians, we are addressing God, and so it goes both ways. But I do have the uncomfortable feeling that more and more, at least in the congregations that I've been serving, we deal more and more with the audience of ourselves. We try to please ourselves or to entertain ourselves, and somehow God gets lost, so that the subjective aspects of worship, I think, are becoming more and more in the culture that I serve in, more and more predominant over just praising God in whatever great and wonderful and perhaps ill-prepared and loud and out-of-tune way that we can. So we want our music to be real neat and nice, or whatever. Does that connect with anybody? Does that have anything to do with how we
In Minneapolis, where I come from, in the last year, two services I attended in two different churches had full orchestras. But they were people from the congregation who were playing in the orchestras. And I don't know if they hired a conductor or not. And it was really beautiful and very moving and everything. What do you think of that? I'm not sure if that's what you're driving at.
I'll comment.
Go ahead, Carl.
Gerhard Kemp said a part about the dealing with moving in the Hispanic community. In other words, looking at their culture and ways you might approach it. And I think I was saying this afternoon, you know, the church I go to, I don't really, in some ways, I don't know if I really need to go, because I know exactly what's going to happen from 11 a.m. until 12 noon. I mean,
well,
the way the crash is going to put his robe over the altar, and the way he's going to kneel, and the way he's going to pray, and then just step by step in the worship service. Now, I really love Lutheran liturgy. I like the liturgy, except for the third setting in the Green Book, and I like the Red Book liturgies, and I like the first, second settings of the Green Book, and I like a lot of liturgies I hear with my Catholic brethren and so forth. But my feeling is that, you know, what was kind of refreshing here at Holden was some new, when you say experiences, some new experiences in worship, new forms. But there was still a, you know, kind of a constancy in the body of what was given. So I think that in terms of worship, maybe this is the great advantage we have right now, is that we have a wider range potential through the Black experience, through the Hispanic, Native American, Asian, that would allow some variations in forms and some kinds of. I love orchestras in church. In one of our churches, we had some dance. Some people had a little problem with that, and we used clown ministry in one of our churches, and some different forms that attempt to allow us to reach up, or to reach up and to reach out. And so I think that from my standpoint, I would like to see some constancy in what we have in terms of good Lutheran liturgy, but at the same time to provide a greater number of variations. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think the way I respond to that, Marilyn, it's all in the way that it's done. If it's done as obviously a part of the worship, like you have seen dance done in mm-hmm. the
liturgical dance, like
that was definitely praise to God and part of the service. But then there are times when people get up and perform, and that I don't. If it's presented that way, yeah, I don't like that.
Well, I wasn't criticizing it necessarily. I just threw that out as a possible sort of focal point for it. I could see it being abused. I don't think it has yet because it's so new. But on the other hand, it's also really, I mean, clearly a privileged group of people who can play a musical instrument that well, so many of them in one congregation. I mean, these are I'm talking orchestra, I'm not talking rhythm band and stuff like that. Then on the other hand, I saw a 5-member summer choir at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Seattle. I don't know if you're familiar with that church. It's down in the inner city, and it has maybe a congregation of 30 total, and of those, probably 15 are usually in the tank. And it was so wonderful that the music was just fantastic. 5 people, one of them was the minister's wife, one of them was the intern, and the other 3 were church members, and everybody sang along. And it was an authentic expression of that church's praise, and their I don't know. I'm happy to see some diversity in worship, but I understand the problems you're raising are more in terms of, are they, do they have integrity? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, in part. Let me jump down to this part. Maron, you used the term authentic. If I am going to be authentically Walt Johnson, there's a fairly narrow range of responses that I can make, whether to God or to anyone else. You know, it's taken a number of years to put me together the way that I am, and I can grow a bit. But I am, you know, to a large degree who I am at this point. So that if I am to offer up to God that who I am, I think it's important that be authentically me and mine. It's got to be my stuff. My level of musical talent when it comes to singing or tooting a horn or whatever that may be. Also, my collection of cultural stuff is what I need to put in my prayer to God. However, seems to me, while authenticity and integrity has something to do with what I offer God in the way of praise, and each of you offering too, your own bundle of stuff, here's a whole area in which I think we might have more room for creativity and freedom. Because here, I think, as receivers, I speak for myself, I do have a fairly good set of ears, and I enjoy music of different kinds and things. So if somebody on behalf of God wants to communicate to me, or if they will allow me the privilege of overhearing their praise directed to God, here is the place where I think some cultural diversity has a great possibility of entering in. And I think this is where I have so thoroughly enjoyed the worship in the black style these last few days. I didn't feel that I had to have the proper rhythm, you know, when we were clapping our hands. I just am always offbeat on those things. And yet I found that I was receiving. And I was receiving a great deal of joy, at least, and perhaps some other things. So I guess I wanted to make that distinction. I don't think it's very subtle, is it? That as we look for ways perhaps to enliven worship, and not for that purpose, but to give evidence of the Catholicity and the breadth of the church, that I guess I would just like to have these two concerns kept in mind. That if I am called upon to do something, I want it to be authentically my stuff. But I also need to be enlarged and fed and have my whole vision expanded by that which the other cultures can add in. Now, I've never tried to structure a one-hour worship service, you know, in that particular way. I don't know, I'm not interested in that kind of practicality at this point. But also, I guess what I'm not interested in is simply doing something that sounds kind of neat and warm just because they do it somewhere else. You know, sure, we can do a demonstration service on how the people in China worship, but that's probably about what it's going to be. It's a demonstration. Then I think whatever we can learn from that, we need to work into our own stuff. I don't think it means we need to learn a whole repertoire of Chinese spiritual songs. I assume there are such things. I'm sure there are. Well, so much for that. What do you want to talk about? Do you want to talk about these? Or something else?
I don't know if this is the bridge between the two, but I think the problem that we have in our worship in terms of cultural domination has to do with our separation from other people. And that's, for me, that's largely a product of different social classes and backgrounds that I think makes authentic worship very difficult, because as I understand, at least the prophetic message is that worship outside of a commitment to justice between peoples is empty. And that's how I experience it. And I think the way that we've structured our society and our lives is that there's an enormous cultural as well as other separation between those peoples. And I think the blessing of this week and the blessing of my time in Central America was that gap got closed a little bit. And I began to realize some of my own spiritual bankruptcy because of that isolation. So I think that the cultural gap is a really big one in this society, because we're separated from people and their experiences.
Yeah. And just to add to that, I was thinking something similar. I was thinking about a conversation with Pete Pirro, and picking up on what Jax just said, essentially a service done by Chinese could be seen as a demonstration. It could also be a chance for us to see worship through, as much as possible, through the eyes of other people. And that's maybe we shouldn't always see it as things that will just sort of make us feel, I agree with you, just sort of make us feel good and have sort of a warm feeling about them. But if it can be a way of really seeing worship and relationship with God and that whole sort of vision through the eyes of other people through worship, I think that's the direction we need to see things, and not even necessarily things that we're going to incorporate in our own worship, other than if we do that more and experience that more, then what you were saying is that if you're called on something to do something, then that needs to be authentically yours. Well, maybe what is authentically yours may change because of those other experiences.
Yeah, if I hear the prophetic word
right
from that other culture who understands the faith somewhat differently or expresses it differently, sure, I can grow and change. So I hear some of you saying that this is what I meant by the prophetic dimension. I put it in quotes. I always put terms in quotes when I know they don't clearly communicate, but I don't know a better way to say it. So that in addition to caring for ourselves and those in our immediate local community, I think I hear saying that in some fashion or other, we need to do more than that. There needs to be an acknowledgement, or perhaps even some bringing in something from outside our particular culture that says, yes, there is more out there. This is not abnormal. We do a lot of subversive teaching under the guise of worship. At least I do. I suppose everyone does. How many of you have had Pentecost has become kind of a popular festival of the church again? Have your congregations all been doing weird things on Pentecost? Haven't you?
Different people, three from different nationalities. In
yeah,
church.
That kind of thing.
We've had several languages.
Yeah.
My problem here, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I come from a church like Carl's where, you know, I know exactly what's going to happen from 11 to 12, and, you know, there's no, everything's planned beforehand, and there's no talking about it now, you know, like it's more informal.
I keep pushing the worship committee, and I keep going to meetings, and I raise a little bit here. We do have one good introduction. Our young assistant pastor has come in. He's a ventriloquist, and he has his dummy Theodore. That's given me a whole new perspective of the church. And it's kind of, he'll do some children's sermons. We also very good. Our preacher's excellent. I want to tell you, I appreciate our preacher and our pastor because he stimulates me intellectually and spiritually. I have no question the sermon is kind of the same stuff. But this new young guy has come in and he's kind of given a little excitement. He'll do the children's sermons and it's made some people have a little trouble with it. But for me, I think it's just been fantastic.
Because it's too different?
Well, just I think they feel that the ventriloquist and the dummy Theodore is a little too
that's
much
too
for worship service. But I mean, it was, the other day he hadn't dressed in the service. It was just kind of cute. There's a little guy in the front row that had a shirt just like Theodore. He says he's got a shirt just like I have. And he walked back and said something to the theater. Said something to the pastor. And of course, the congregation just kind of livened up. And I felt well, that was. The gospel was there, and worship was there, and it didn't.
And
to
first,
me,
first time they ever laughed, right?
No, we laughed.
Yeah.
Laugh
but
we
I
can
see this
as
a real
joke.
Problem.
Every sermon has a joke.
Yeah,
I think she's trying. She's been trying to talk here.
But I mean, is you know, there's with the black community, it seems to me that they kind of plan it as they go along, which is rather informal compared to what we have, and. My church, there's no black people. I mean, there's just not. We welcome in Cambodians, a Vietnamese family, and if the Norwegian Lutherans could get together from their dissension back in the 1800s, early 1900s, then maybe the blacks and whites can. But I'm glad I'm not a pastor to figure out how to preach today because you got the young and the old, you got the, you know, teenagers in there, you got rich and the poor, and you got blacks and whites now, if that's for all of, you know, the nationalities, and it must be tough to know how to preach, because how are you going to reach everybody? And the styles are so different that I can see it's a real problem in communities where there are blacks and whites, and how to get them together. How do you do that? Is that the question you're saying?
Sometimes I think, well, let me put it this way. We've got a lot of uptight preachers out there because of the kinds of things you've said. It's not as easy as it used to be. The reason our preachers are uptight, by and large, is they're trying to please the folks. And are basically, I think most of them are trying pretty hard. And so the tendency then is to get real rigid about that. Because you want to present a good worship experience. Because that's what we think the people want. If the Holy Spirit wants something in our Sunday morning worship, she's got to get in the bulletin by 9:30 Friday morning. Because
literally in our church, the bulletin goes out on Tuesday.
But how neat if some of the members of our congregations would approach their clergy and say simply, you know, it's okay if mistakes are made.
Yeah.
It's okay if at the last minute you decide that this hymn doesn't seem appropriate because something happened in the course of worship. Yeah. It's okay to change the hymn. It's okay not only to laugh at a well-planned joke written into the script of a sermon, but it's also okay to laugh when some crazy funny thing happens.
Yeah. There's a great example from our church.
I think a part of that is the pastoral care of the laity toward the pastor, just to help them to know that they can relax and do what comes naturally. Without the wrath of the church council coming down on their head, and maybe it will, but at least they'll know they have some support.
Or it's okay for the part of the choir to start over again.
Oh yeah.
Without getting embarrassed.
You know, in every congregation, there's just all kinds of funny stories that have happened, and it becomes a part of the community life, and they're important. That's the way we develop our sense of community. We have our own funny and tragic stories in our congregations. And we share those, and they're great. But if everything's so cotton pick and rigid, you don't have any story, and you can't get any community.
Well, I think also what happens, I've moved around a lot, so I do a lot of church shopping, and being a single person and being a woman makes it real hard to find a church that's accepting and caring. And when I talk to pastors and I say those questions, you know, okay, and I get the answers, well, we've got the young people and the old people. And not only does it get rigid, it also gets real watered down. And the message, you know, that you were talking about of justice and, you know, the true gospel message isn't there because they're trying to meet all those needs. And somehow it seems that if you can bring that true gospel message, then the cultural differences that need to happen in worship wouldn't be such a big deal if you could just somehow make that happen. And, you know, and I know that's idealistic, but then you would get out of that mold and, you know, just focus on the fact of justice and caring about people as people.
Yeah. Sensitivity is the word that keeps coming to my mind.
Yeah.
I also keep thinking in terms of the liturgy. I mean, for me, the liturgy isn't very meaningful. And I like spontaneity a lot. And for me, that I can worship easier in that than having something printed before me that I'm supposed to say every time. It just doesn't do it for me. And I don't remember who it was this week, but at some session, one person said, "I wonder if you did a survey in your conversation, how many people really say they get a lot out of the service on Sunday morning?" And it was a he. I remember. I don't remember who it was. He said, "I think very, very few." And I think, I know me, I just feel really strange. I grew up, my dad's a pastor, his dad was a pastor, the whole family pastors. I feel really strange if we get up on a Sunday morning and Jack says, "Oh, I just really don't want to go to church." I said, "Jack, we gotta go to church." It's not necessarily guilt, it's just, that's me. I go to church on Sunday morning, you know, and to not do it just makes me feel just...
And you leave mad.
And then I leave mad because I went to church and I didn't get anything out of it, Dad, bless it. And, you know, I've just...
Been that for 60 years, too, you know, it's just the same.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, our church is the same thing. It's just so structured. The pastor is a great preacher, but the rest of it is just...
You know what our pastor says about that? He says it doesn't matter what the fat preacher's preach as long as we have the liturgy, you know, because that's God's word to us today.
And yeah, and
that's on the other side of what you're saying. You know, that's all you need.
Well, I've just been appointed to our forward planning committee, and I don't know how many have ever been on anything like that. Matter of fact, we don't even know what we're supposed to do.
I'm on the backward plan.
we're having fun with it, Mother, you know. We're talking about needs for a 5-year plan of the congregational needs as individuals and congregational expectations. And, you know, you talk about, when I was a kid, wasn't a kid about church council, you know, the music committee, all these people, you know, I don't know, I think they're maybe out there looking to see who their worship are those expectations being met by the pastor. And we're really, our committee is having a ball, because we're doing 5-year projections, trying to needs and expectations of members of the congregation by age group, sex, the whole thing. And we're right now, we're about this far off the ground. We're finding things like the question of what should the liturgy be? What should we have? What kind of service should we have? Should we allow the pastor more freedom to the autonomy to go out and do something different? Because we know that, I think that way he's going to do 3 years from now, you know, maybe give it Sunday, you know. And our forward planning group, we're trying to break a mold that a church 3 years old. We're going uphill.
I really like the idea of planning for the future of the sort that says, let's loosen up the future. That's interesting. Most of our planning says let's pin the future down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that I have a real problem with, a real theological problem with, and our congregation is really, really big on that, so I have a very economic problem with it too.
I know there have been a lot of surveys done in those kinds of situations.
Do you have any extra? We've been looking for those, and we can't get, we're going to make our own.
Well, and this is what I was saying, is that gets back to my earlier point, that why we need other people is because in most of the surveys that I've seen, what they come back is, and they try to prioritize what are the priorities of people in the congregation. We're going to try to shape the congregation to meet those priorities. Music, I don't know, I can't remember, but you get down to number 15, community needs, number 23, justice concerns, you know, criticism's too much justice focus, you know, once a year.
We do hunger this year, though.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite lines. I preach on hunger and speak on hunger a lot, and I'll go into a congregation almost every time, and I'll hear someone kind of fumbling through the bulletin saying, we did hunger last year. and again, it's a sign of that separation, that we don't... There's a problem if we're an exclusive community in establishing priorities to better meet the needs of our community, if we want to be a church, which is the church of the family of God. And how to break through that is so difficult.
How about if they have a new Lutheran book of worship and they have some Negro spirituals and some Hispanic songs in there? Would that help any? And just sing them?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is I think we have to think of a new way of being church. And I think that means that maybe some of us need to move out of our neighborhoods. I think some of it, that we need to open up our churches and become sanctuaries. I mean, that's opened up the doors of a lot of churches in terms of bringing whole new understanding of historical reality as well as worship life. So I think it's going to have to be more than just what we put in our hymnal. It's going to be somehow changing our lives and redefining what it means to be church.
You know, we asked one of the things we tried to get our congregation to do, which they thought was the most radical thing, was we wanted to do some swapping with one of the churches in Tacoma. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with Peace.
Where are you?
We're in Enumclaw. There's two of them there.
Yeah.
If you know Enumclaw's like.
I know Enumclaw, but yeah.
Okay. Well, we made the recommendation that we take our youth, we take everybody, and let's go to Peace Lutheran in Tacoma, which is unique. I feel.
There's a lady here from Peacefield.
Who's that?
Mayor, the lady. Mm-hmm. First time I think it's a teacher.
But when they they asked me, so what's Peace Lutheran like? And I said, well, it's interracial, it's intermarriage, it handles people of all handicaps as if they're men. And they said, well, I didn't think that was too good of an idea to expose our people to that kind of
thing. See, that's the sad thing, that kind of church has to be unique. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think of, you know, I work with emotionally disturbed kids. We have 14 kids in our program. These are kids from poverty homes, from real split families. And then I'm supposed to work with these folks on the weekday, but then go and worship at a church that's middle class and doesn't meet their needs and doesn't even see them as people in the community of value. You know, and it just doesn't mesh, you know.
There's one thing that happened at the Ring in Jersey altar call. I don't know how, but do they do that often in church now, often? And that was a wonderful experience. And I think of all the experiences I had was the altar call. I serve as assisting minister occasionally with our pastor and liturgist and so forth. And so I get the prayer of the church. I think one time I indicated, I said, I'd really love to do an altar call someday for people. You know, when you ask for that space in there for the concerns of the church. I said, I really need somebody to call those who have some kind of need or for prayer and call up around the altar like we did the other night. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I've been asked to be assisting minister since I imagine that.
Yeah. Because, you know, talking about, you know, different concerns, the hunger and, you know, our minister is a very good preacher, that people want to hear that everything's okay when they go to church. And they don't want to hear things, because I'm a Christian, my life's going to be wonderful. And that outreach just somehow doesn't want to be there. And we've had people leave the church because they want to be uplifted when they come to church. And they don't want to hear the needs.
Yeah. That is a part of our culture. And I think in our conversation in recent minutes, and I need to officially wrap this up, I think, so you can get on to doing whatever the Holden culture does at 10 o'clock. We started talking about worship practice and how culture affects that. Wasn't very long before we plowed way underneath that and talked about our life together in the community of the church. And I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but what we've really been talking about is how our white American Christian culture affects the whole structure of our congregations and what we do and how we think. When we want to know what to do 5 years from now, we don't go to the gospel, but we go to the corporate models of long-range planning. We poll the citizenry that is within our reach, because this is what's done in our culture. We find out what the people want, and then we try to give it to them. I didn't plan a summary, but I guess what I would like to think could happen in a way would be that if in our worship life we were able to allow some of those other cultures and the gospel itself to speak to us, and perhaps the gospel can speak to us more clearly if it catches our attention through a black spiritual or haiku poetry or something. That if that begins then to penetrate, then our church council members, our congregational leaders, our clergy will say, hey, how about justice? Do you think maybe we're just trying to please one another and make one another feel good? There is this cult, really, of feeling good.
There is.
And let's just focus on the positive, you know. We've heard some of that here this week. You know, let's talk about how far we have come, rather than the challenge of the gospel to go much, much farther and much, much deeper.